Hey, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Matthew Aaron Show. We are at www.thematthewaaronshow.com. On Twitter, we're at Matt Aaron Show. On Facebook, you can find us by plugging us into the search bar, The Matthew Aaron Show. You can be listening to us on Stitcher, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, or my new favorite outlet for you to listen to us, which is Spotify. That's right. Go download Spotify. If you don't use it already, you're gonna. It's a product I use and I love, and I'm not even getting paid to say this. I use Spotify. I have the unlimited package. I follow all the best podcasts on there, whether it be Joe Rogan, whether it be Conrad Thompson, whether it be ours, The Matthew Aaron Show. I follow our podcast over there. So download Spotify, and if you type in The Matthew Aaron Show and just click follow, you will get all our podcasts just getting, boom, as soon as one comes out, coming your way. I know you guys are here for one reason and one reason only today, and that's to hear the oral history of Whiskey Cavalier as told by David Hemmingson. And I like this episode so much that in the future, I'm wondering if we're going to maybe do more oral histories, or if we're going to alternate shows between guests and oral histories, because I loved talking to Dave about this, and I think you're going to see what I mean. If you're a Whiskey Cavalier fan, this is must-listen material. You are going to get the inside scoop on everything from the beginning of the show to the end of the show. And who better to tell you than the creator and executive producer, writer, director, my good friend, David Hemmingson. And he's going to take it away right now. All right, this is Matthew Aaron, and I am here with David Hemmingson. And today we are going to talk about Whiskey Cavalier. And Dave and I have been talking, and I wanted to basically do this show a little differently than we always do it, which is this time I want to just go chronologically through the process of making a TV show. Mm-hmm. And because I find this a really fascinating show where it was one season, but even to the end, it was super hot. Huh. So I think this is a really interesting way of looking at this. So let's talk about Whiskey Cavalier, and let's talk about where the idea came from first, because everything's with an idea.
Sure, absolutely. Okay. It's all the origin story of the show. Well, it's funny, this one, interesting, I just came back from this guy's house. A number of years ago, about 6 years ago, I got a call at about 3:30 in the morning. And normally, you know, you get a call 3:30 in the morning, it's one of three things. One is, you know, possibly, and I've been married and faithful to the same woman for 23 years, so it's like, someone looking to hook up. That hasn't happened to me in decades. So it's not that. The second thing is, I'm in jail. I've had a couple of those calls where I got to go, you know, bail somebody out. And then the third thing is obviously something like something terrible. And when I noticed the person who, I'm going to use his name because now the show's over and we were together this week, I said I could use his name. My friend Eugene Casey, I saw the name and we've been friends since high school, and I was like shocked 3:30 in the morning. So I pick up and I immediately said, "Eugene, all right?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm fine." And my wife is sort of shifting the bed next to me. She said, "What's going on?" I'm like, no, it's okay. I said, are your parents all right? And he said, no, they're fine. And I kind of said, "Why the fuck are you calling me at 3:30 in the morning?" You know? And he said, "Oh, is it 3:30? I'm so sorry, I forgot." And the bottom line is I just got back from Saudi Arabia. Now, this will give you some context on who Eugene is. Eugene is an FBI agent who had been like seconded to various like task forces all over the world to fight things like, you know, he was an expert in white collar crime, but he also had done time in Utah with the FBI. But he became after 9/11 became a terrorist financing expert, and then like is very good with weapons. So then he started going on these trips to Saudi Arabia with the CIA, you know. And so he's now traveling all over the world post 9/11 to sort of thwart terrorism. And he said to me, I'm just really sorry. So I just had a, well, you know, I used the name on the show we used for. It's like, you know, I just broke up with Gigi. And I was like, yeah, I know, I'm really sorry about that, brother. He goes, we've been doing some talking on the phone, some phone therapy, and I don't know, man, I just feel like I'm in a really bad place with it. And I said, I sent you a did you get my email? I'm like, no, it's 3:30 in the morning, motherfucker. I haven't looked at my email. And he goes, well, I just sent you this email. It's my breakup playlist. And he goes, it's about 2.5 hours long. He said, you know, when I was off in Riyadh, the guys from the CIA said that it was too heavily into the Smiths, you know, too much Morrissey. So I wanted some fresh eyes on it. You know, we've been friends forever. So if you could edit my breakup playlist, that really helped me. And could you do it quickly? Because I'm going off to the Horn of Africa to break up the sex trafficking ring. So I was like, okay. So I hung up. And I was like, oh, I'll do this in the morning. And my wife said to me, Eugene? And I was like, yeah. And she goes, Gigi? And I said, yeah. And she goes, oh, God.
And so your wife's used to
odd calls from Eugene and my friends.
2 a.m., 4 a.m.
So, yeah, so it's like, okay. So she's like, oh, God. And so I laid it for 10 seconds, Matthew. And then I jumped up. She's like, now where are you going? I got to write this down. 6 years ago, I ran up. Basically, in 4 hours, wrote the entire premise of the show up, which is basically...
Now, were you interested in Eugene's life before this show? And when I say life, obviously him being in the CIA is a big interest.
FBI.
Big interest right there, right? But then you're like, wait, I know this guy in real life. He has a real love life. He has a real, like, he's a single guy. He's a bachelor. There's something fascinating about this.
It's like, you know, it's like Scott Foley's character, Will Chase. He was named Will Chase because I was like, he will chase you.
Yeah, right. That's good.
But he was sort of like, I'm like, I knew this guy as a dear friend from high school. And my understanding of him as an FBI agent was sort of thing we'd all get sit around with beers, you know, me and all my high school buddies. And Eugene would regale us, he's a super, super, like, humble guy, about all this crazy shit, like kicking in doors and getting attacked by dogs. And we'd be like, oh, my God. But you have to understand, Matthew, he was a poetry major at Cornell. Like, this guy was like a sensitive, like, English major who became an FBI agent. So he's this guy who just wanted love and kind of had chosen poorly with this girl, and it was this sort of beautiful romantic, you know, but with you know, a Sig Sauer on his hip and a .38 on his ankle, kicking indoors. And I'm like, all I kept thinking was, like, I've never seen sensitive James Bond. So the origin story was like, shit.
Fascinating. And that's the one line right there, sensitive James Bond. Yeah, totally.
And the thing is also is the breakup playlist, which...
Yeah. Which is so high fidelity.
It's in the whiskey pilot where he's like, you know, there's a CD on the floor. It's like breakup playlist number 2, and I put it there on purpose. And he's watching You Got Mail. He's like crying along to Bonnie Tyler. The only thing Eugene, and he was the technical advisor, by the way, on the show, got upset about was the Bonnie Tyler.
The Bonnie Tyler.
He was like, I do not listen to Bonnie Tyler. I said, listen, man. I said, I needed to convey Ugly Cry. And I said, you know, I wanted to convey Ugly Cry, and it's very hard to get Ugly Cry behind, like, you know, How Soon Is Now.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, the Smiths are great, but it's very hard to get it behind, like, you know, Girlfriend in a Coma.
Yeah.
Like, you want something a little more, you want to build a bigger tent.
Yep. So for him, Ugly Cry, did he have other options, or was Bonnie Tyler, you just settled, you're like, we're going to do Bonnie Tyler?
I wrote it from the get-go, and it's the one thing that Peter Roth, who's the president of Warner Brothers, read, and he was like, I love this. And Peter Roth, when we got picked up, called me up and was singing Bonnie Tyler to me when I picked up the phone. I was like, hello, and he's like, turn around. So that was people love the Bonnie Tyler song.
I don't know if I want Peter Roth calling me.
It's totally eclipse of the heart. But it was, I thought it was kind of great because it's sort of like, to me, it was just sort of like, you know, and there was a brief push for, like, we should put a really hot pop song in there. I'm like, no, because here's the thing. It would have been Smith if it was huge, but, you know, if you're going for, I don't know about you, Matthew, but if I'm going for an Ugly Cry, I want to get really kind of like morose and blue, I'm going to find shit on my playlist that from high school that is going to take me back to that emotional moment. So I really wanted to go really old school.
It's been a long time, but the one song I can remember for sure, Ugly Cry for me, is Springsteen's Secret Garden.
Of course.
Does it for me every time.
Of course.
And not just because of Jerry Maguire, but I'm also a huge Springsteen guy.
Yeah, me too.
So, like, you put them together and it was just like...
Everybody's got
Cameron Crowe's a good Ugly Cry.
Cameron Crowe, in terms of your soundtrack and in terms of your licensing masters, like Cameron Crowe
really
is the master. Yeah. So it jumped up out of this... And basically I wanted to... And the whole Ray character for me was I just needed somebody to... be a foil that was close to me, because the whole thing that I discovered about people in the FBI and CIA, and I have friends from the CIA and went to college is that they want what we all want, which is like, well, they want love, they want connection, they want someone to be with, you know, and they're smart people, but they're also incredibly brave people, but it's a very lonely life. And so the two things I learned was it's mostly about trust, as it is with any relationship, but it's amplified because secrecy and deception is their tradecraft.
Yeah.
So how do you trust somebody? And the answer
especially
is,
with a guy like Eugene, it's long term all the time. Yeah. I'm assuming unless he's meeting someone on an assignment.
And the thing is, you can't talk to people.
Yeah.
Right? Really, you can't tell them what you do. You can't tell them particulars. And honestly, if you're dating a civilian, you don't know what their agenda is. Like, you know, especially now with the great game on, with the big powers, Russia and China and stuff, you hook up with somebody, they may be running you. They may be running a game on you. So it's sort of like, you know, if you're going to date outside, and that's why...
Duplicity.
Yeah, right. Precisely correct, my friend. The other thing is, like, that's why, you know, Fiery Tribune, that's why Frankie Trowbridge. Because not only did I need an opposite number, but I wanted him to be attracted to somebody in the... In the security services, because that's what kind of works best for them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, kind of, for lack of a better term, like agency incest, because who else are you going to trust but another spy?
Right.
You know, on your side,
right?
You know,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's kind of like, you know, Allied in that way. That great. I don't know, listeners. I don't know how you feel about Allied, but I was a fan. I know it's flawed, but the idea of like two spies getting together is always.
Hey, well, Allied was good, but when like I was bringing up a little earlier, the film Duplicity.
Yeah.
There were some similarities between the show and with that movie, where it's a very interesting exploration of, oh wait, these spies.
Yeah.
Not only have to worry about everyone around them,
but each
other. They have wives.
Yeah, each other.
And even in that movie, they're sleeping with each other and they still can't trust each other.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Which is actually, I'm glad you brought that up, was what killed it as a feature project. The reason it was developed as a feature project.
Really?
And 6 years ago. And
I can see that.
It gained a lot of traction. And, you know, there was originally, and the weird thing was, it's one of those weird, like, almost like songwriting experiences, like McCartney, and I'm not comparing this at all, but
sure.
I got out of bed and had Yesterday in its entirety. This one, I literally sat up and I wrote, like, a 19-page feature outline. My wife, like, took off to go somewhere at 11 in the morning, and she, you know, and this is like, you know, it's 3:30. I've been 8 hours at the computer just writing this whole thing out straight. So it all kind of fell together, and then I started shopping as a feature. I got some traction as a feature.
Yeah.
And then, like you're saying, Duplicity, a movie called This Means War came out.
Yes, with
Chris Pine.
Reese Witherspoon. Chris Pine and Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
And it shit the bed.
Yeah.
And so...
Totally different tone than your viewers and everything, too.
But this had some sort of traction on it, and then that came out, and all of a sudden...
No one wants to make a spy movie at that point.
A spy romance movie goes away. So, 6 years later, I'm over at Warner Brothers, talking to Aaron Wehrenberg, who's a senior VP of comedy, and I'd been working on a couple of scripts for the... I've gotten on ABC deals working at Warner Brothers, had two scripts still there, and I was like... You know,
was this when you were working on Blackish, or...?
It was after I left ABC Studios and had gone kind of free solo.
Yeah, you're on your own, free agent.
Precisely right. And I wrote, in rapid succession, three pilots, because I just had a lot of stuff bottled up inside me that were more kind of cable or streaming pilots. And Warner Bros. Had run a couple of those pilots, and they were like, we'd like to have you come in. So we love your scripts. I was like, that's very kind of you. And I said, do you want to produce them? Like, no, we'd like to write two other ones. So I was like, okay. So I write two other ones. So I was working on those, and we couldn't quite seem to find the traction we wanted with those two pitches. And then somebody suggested to go over and meet Bill Lawrence because he wants to do something in the hour-long space. So I was like, I'd never met Bill. Now, I'd worked with everybody in my life out here. I'd kind of worked with Bill, but I'd never worked with Bill. And we never met.
So at this point, you're sitting on the 17-page feature outline, the treatment, the scriptment, whatever you want to call it, for Whiskey. But it's not a pilot yet.
No.
And you're going to go meet with Bill Lawrence over. He has a deal at Warner Brothers.
He has an overall deal at Warner Brothers. Yeah. So I go over there, and I walk in, and... you know, Warner Bros. Said, like, you know, go meet with Bill. He wants to talk to you about an hour-long idea. So I go, okay. So I go in, and I sit down with Bill and Jeff Engel, and Bill goes, so what do you got? And my first response was, what do you mean, what do I got?
I thought I'm talking to you about your idea.
Exactly. So and it was one of those fateful moments, Matthew, where you're sitting here going, like, I don't know, man. I got this call literally... 5 hours ago. I'm like, yeah, I'll have a conversation. You know, I'm always up for one of the key things in Hollywood is always be willing to have a conversation. So I was like, you know, and I thought for a moment, I'm like, you know what, dude, I don't really have anything, but it's been emotional, you know, and let's talk again soon when I come with. But for some reason, Matthew, I just sort of went, I got a second to call Whiskey Cavalier, and I literally had to reach down into my memory banks and like dust off the pitch, and I pitched him, for anybody who's seen the show, I pitched him the concept of basically, you know, sensitive James Bond ends up trying to retrieve, at the time, Edgar Stanch was basically Edward Snowden, and discovers his opposite number and a hard-ass CIA agent. And the way I pitched the show was, basically, it's Mission Impossible smashes into Cheers with Scott Foley as Diane Chambers and Lauren Cohen as Sam Malone.
Yeah, that's the brilliance of it,
Thank you. And I pitched that to Bill, and Bill's, you know, a great producer, and he... He sat there for a second, like literally like 2 seconds. He goes, "Yeah, do you have Scott Foley?" I was like, "For my television."
Yeah, right.
And I'd actually worked in Shondaland the previous year, and I knew certain people.
Oh, that's right. He was Scandal.
I was on the. He was in Scandal, but I was
Scott was on Scandal.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I was on the Fix.
Because we all remember Scott. I believe it was Felicity.
Felicity,
right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he's got right. In Cougar Town.
But Felicity's when he became like a big heartthrob.
Precisely.
Yeah, right. Him and Scott Speedman.
Exactly right. Yeah. There's the rivalry there.
Yeah, right.
So So I was like, I don't know him because I think you guys get along. So I go to, I think, Sweet Salt in the Valley, off Ventura Boulevard.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah. Sweet Salt. Yeah.
So for breakfast the next day.
Yeah.
Or the day after. And I sit down with Scott Foley, and we immediately hit it off because we're two family guys. He's got 3 kids. I got 2 kids. And so we have a plate of eggs, and we're talking. And he goes, so what do you got? And I kind of pitch him exactly what I pitched Bill. And there was like a long pause. And he was like, yeah, I could play that character. And I'm like, yeah, man, I had to build something in the fucking lab.
I was going to say, if you were going to look at a guy.
Yeah. I was like, if I had to build something in the fucking lab, then I couldn't build somebody better than you for this.
It would look like Scott Foley.
Yeah, precisely. Right. It would look like Scott Foley.
Yeah. So, my mom loved this show, and she loves Scott Foley. And I go, well, yeah, it looks like it was tailored for Scott.
Yeah.
Funny enough, it wasn't, but that's how the best projects happen.
Exactly. It was this real serendipity. It was like with Kitchen Confidential. Like, I didn't know who Jack Rodan was going to be, and then Bradley Cooper was like our first choice was Robert Downey Jr. on that one.
Yeah.
We negotiated with him for like 2 weeks, and then that fell away. There were like 3 other actors.
Was that right after Ally McBeal Downey Jr.?
Yeah, we couldn't bond him at the time.
Right.
He was unbondable.
Yep.
Because the shit that had happened, and there were like a couple other actors who fell out. And then literally, and I'm digressing for a second, so forgive me, but I was literally in Darren Starr's office and somebody brought in a tape of Bradley Cooper from
Alias?
Deb Borilsky from Alias.
Oh, yeah.
And Deb Borilsky, our casting director, brought it and I watched it. And when the tape ended, it was a videotape, that's how long ago it was, 15 years ago. I turned off, I was like, fuck me, Darren. I said, that's the guy. And Darren initially was like, Bradley Cooper? And I was like, yeah. He goes, I had him on Mismatch, and I think he's kind of best friend with Yoga Matt. He's Will Tippin. I'm like, no, he's a rock star. You know, and I felt the same way about Scott. I was sort of like, you're this guy.
Now, Scott, you knew from Scandal. So you've seen some of his work.
And The Unit.
Okay, so you've seen some of his work.
Yes, and Felicity, I'd seen some of his work,
But so what sold you more, that you knew Scott's work, or that when you met Scott for that breakfast, you're like, wait a minute, this is perfect?
It was kind of a combination thereof. You know, and
I knew he had the tools.
I knew he had the tools.
But then meeting him, you were like, this works.
This guy's the sensitive guy. It's like one of those, he's one of those rare guys in Hollywood who is just, you know how people are attracted to him, I think, because they sense his fundamental, like, niceness?
Yeah.
It's just who he is.
Yeah.
And I got that. And so it just, dude, I gotta be candid, it just went like a rocket sled from
there. I asked you off the interview. I said, Scott's low maintenance, isn't he? And
totally
you told me he's totally low maintenance.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is I look at Scott and I go, he looks like a cool, chill dude.
Wonderful guy.
Yeah.
Wonderful guy. He's a wonderful guy.
He looks nice. Like you said, it's everything that he portrays, everything that he beams off of, that's him.
That's him.
Yeah.
And so attaching him allowed us to sort of gain a little more traction. And so, you know, obviously I went to script. And I got very lucky with this one because I think, it benefited greatly from having 6 years kind of in the heater.
Sure.
You know, it was sort of laying back in the memory banks for 6 years. And I love the genre. I'd never written action before. For all you writers out there, I'll tell you the secret to writing anything, whether it's action or comedy or anything, is like, you know, I just went to the best. I went to like Richard Wenk. I went to, you know, did the Equalizer movies. I went to all the guys who wrote. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Haggis obviously did some rewrites on the Bond films. I went to Neil Purvis. I went to the great action writers, and I just like basically crash coursed myself over the course of like a week where I just did nothing but read action screenplays.
Haggis is great because Haggis is one of those writers that's always helping out other writers.
Yeah.
He's everyone I talk to, and I've had a brief moment with Paul Haggis, and it's he's always willing to give someone advice.
Yeah.
He seems like just a really writer's writer.
Yeah, he is a writer's writer, and he's a really smart and kind of a courageous guy.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
And I feel like that was hugely important. So, to be totally candid, I just got really lucky. I wrote the script, and then all of a sudden...
Now, who reads the script and goes, you got the action stuff right?
It was Bill and Jeff Engel, his partner.
So they're the first ones that read it?
Yeah.
You gave it to them
and
first?
I passed it on to Warner Brothers, and they really responded to it, and then... that there was some momentum there. And then when we went wide with it, all of a sudden it was like, you know, we got, I'll say something, for the listeners, I'll say that my heart is broken by the cancellation show. I love that show, the core of my being. And it was one of the easiest things to cast, because sometimes you get lucky and lightning strikes and all of a sudden there's some momentum. And once he was attached, it just started falling together. It just started falling into place. And
everyone wanted to work with Scott.
Yeah, totally. And it was like, you know, so we had all the answers. But the big thing is who's going to be Fiery Tribune? Like, who's going to be Frank Trowbridge?
Now, at this time, you're just at Warner Brothers, not at ABC yet. You're not shopping the show?
ABC bought the script.
Okay, they did. Okay. Yeah.
But
are you a go at this point?
We're not a go. No.
Okay, so you got Scott Foley.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, we attached Scott as a producer, which allowed us to sort of get some juice. The script comes in January. Now we're a go. Now we start casting.
Okay.
So we saw tons of people, but
do you think ABC was interested because the script's great? They've worked with you, and because it's Scott on Scandal.
We had sold the idea to ABC in a pitch. They hadn't seen the script yet.
Okay.
So Scott and Scandal was a huge part of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when the script came in and it was strong, they were like, "Make this." So
great.
We're like, great. So now we got to cast it.
So here comes January. You got all these other roles. You got the key one, of course, is the chemistry.
Yes.
Yeah.
But strangely enough, Tyler James Williams, I think, and Ortiz is a very good friend of Scott's.
Okay.
That fell into place first. Tyler was a huge get.
Did Scott recommend Ortiz? Or?
Yeah. He was like, Anna would be great in this role. And I watched a bunch of her stuff. And I'm like, yeah, she's perfect for Susan Sampson.
Yeah.
So I was like, great. And then Tyler we saw a bunch of people for the role. There was a guy, a comic who goes, I forget his name, but he goes under the kind of stage name Lance Canstopoulos. He's very funny.
Okay.
And we seriously considered him. There were a bunch of other people who came and we considered. But strangely, I originally wrote it for kind of a logorrhea, kind of running at the mouth, anxiety prone Josh Gad. I wrote for Josh Gad originally.
Oh, okay.
And Josh was unavailable. And Tyler came in. You know, Tyler, of course, had done Everybody Hates Chris and Walking Dead and a bunch of other stuff. He's a wonderful actor with brilliant comic chops and great dramatic chops.
Yeah.
So basically, he did it, and we were all like, this is the guy. So now it's coming down to who's going to be Frankie, you know? And we're all just like, oh my God, I have no idea how to manage this thing. No idea. And we started talking to people, and it was, when you're at that level, Matthew, it's like an offer-only situation.
Right.
So you might get a chemistry read. You probably won't.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you're going for, like, big... Like, my first choice was Kerry Washington.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, she wasn't ready to do another show.
Yeah, she's got done. She doesn't want to jump back in.
Family and stuff. And at this point, we're trying to figure out where to shoot it. Because the great irony was Warner Brothers read it and they were like, great, James Bond, fantastic, James Bond. And then they get the script and they're like, wait a second, this is James Bond.
Yeah, right.
And you're like, but I said that. And they're like, well.
And they're thinking of the numbers in their head.
They're thinking, where are we going to shoot this? You got Paris, you got London, you're out of your fucking mind, you know? And I'm like, yeah, but I told you guys.
This is what you wanted.
Yeah, it's like, and of course, nobody remembers at that point. Yeah, right. They're just like, why would you do this to us? And I'm like, you know? So we're wondering what's going on, and like we're talking to an actress, and she was very hot at the time, you know, and we wanted to, you know, really get somebody with great chemistry with them, but, you know, it's hard to get people in the same room. And then Lawrence People, I'm at dinner one night with my friend Alan Heinberg, who ran the Catch, the show that I was on in Shondaland. We're just having dinner, and Bill calls me and says, Lauren Cohen's representatives have reached out. And I was like, okay. And they're like, do you know who Lauren Cohen is? I'm like, yeah, Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, Maggie, she's hot as shit. I'm like, yeah, she's totally hot right now, and she's a great actress.
Yeah.
And it's like, what do you think? I'm like, I said aggressive yes.
Yeah, right.
So I got on a Skype with her. She was down in Colombia shooting a movie called Mile 22, I think.
Oh, is it the Wahlberg
picture?
One.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Peter Berg.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 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 that record. Sounds about right, yeah.
So she was shooting that. So we got on Skype. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And Peter Tencio was attached. Peter Tencio is our producing director who directed like virtually every frame of Key and Peele, and also directed Keanu, which I love.
Yeah, Keanu. So, we were talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we all got on the phone with her, and she's just like, you know, what are you intending for the character? You know, and I like to think, and I really hope, and I was trying to tease this out in season one, and it was definitely sort of my objective in season two, was for the character to be as real and as emotional and as dimensional as possible. And it, you know, they showed a more comedic bent, and I think given a more, given a longer run, you would have gotten a lot more out of her backstory. But you know, it was pretty clear that she was the person immediately. And so, you know, all of a sudden, for like in terms of shooting now, we're like, we're going to shoot it. So initially,
I was going to ask you, how'd you end up with Prague? Because we talked about this, and I told you about how I did a budget for someone last year. Yeah. You know, taking some odd jobs, took a couple $100 to do a budget for an action movie.
Yeah.
And they're like, we need you to do it, though, for Prague.
Yeah.
And I put the converter in the machine. Sure. It was a $60 million movie.
Yeah.
I go, I don't know how the fuck you're going to make this.
Yeah.
I put it in the converter, and it's like a $15 million movie. Yeah. I go, oh, I see how you're going to make it now.
and that's the magic of Prague. Like, Budapest has that, too.
Yeah.
Budapest is, like, not quite as... Prague is a city that's like a gingerbread city. It's like, I call it the city of gingerbread and alcohol. Because basically, it was never bombed by the Nazis, and there's like 11th century castles, and it's absolutely gorgeous, and all this like kind of turn of the century architecture, and like, you know, Egon Schiele, and like all the Kafka stuff, and bridges, and castles, and cathedrals. It's insane. So initially, what was going to happen was like, you know, they're going, what are we going to do? You wrote this giant thing, and I'm like, oh God, now I'm getting blamed for it. And they're like, what? I don't know. What are we? All right, LA. No, it's too expensive. All right. New York, no, we can't get it permitted. Atlanta, and I'm in the corner, like 40 people in this meeting, Matthew. Like, I'm like, what, a table with like 40 people, and I'm like in the corner, like in the way back, like raising my hand, going, excuse me, I'm a show not creator. Atlanta doesn't really work for the movie. And they're like, Philadelphia. And I'm like, oh my God. And then somebody goes, Budapest.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, all right.
Someone who made an action movie wanted something at Warner Brothers years ago, and they went to Budapest.
Yeah, so it's like Budapest. I'm like, oh, okay. And then somebody goes, wait a second. They go, so it was Budapest for like 48 hours.
Yeah.
And then within those 48 hours, somebody goes, we got a feature that's shooting in Prague.
Yeah.
The feature just got pushed 6 months. We got people on the payroll.
Okay.
We can't move those people off payroll, and then rehire them, we'll lose all these people. How do we make it work? And somebody at Warner Bros. Was like, why don't we just use that feature crew to shoot the Whiskey Cavalier pilot? So we inherited a full-bore feature film crew.
That's
and
part of the reason the pilot looks like a fucking film.
Yeah, it was crazy. And then we just went over to shoot, man, and the shoot was insane. I mean, you know, we blew up a fucking helicopter. You know, we're running around. The great thing is there's all this kind of remainder Soviet armaments. There's a scene where he's being brought in, where Dimitri's, you know, when Frankie and Dimitri have sex, and they're brought into this, like, weapons warehouse.
Yeah.
That thing was full. We couldn't really appreciate the scope of it. That thing literally, Matthew, had 15 Soviet-era tanks, like, artillery, like, just Kalashnikovs everywhere.
And you're
just,
like, use it all.
Yeah, we're like, just hose it down.
Yeah.
Just shoot all of
this. Clean it up and shoot it all. This
and,
is great.
Yeah, and then immediately outside that arena, that was part of an old car factory in Prague, Czech car factory, we basically blew up a helicopter.
Yeah, we saw that, yeah. Yeah, the helicopter blowing up.
Some of that is CGI, but
sure. There
was a huge explosion that we just amplified with CGI.
That's great.
Yeah, so we shot it in Prague, and it was super interesting, super chill. I was 23 years without eating meat. I was like, mostly vegetarian, ate a little fish. Got to Prague within a week. I'm like, you know, what do you guys have to eat? It's like, we have Nile perch. I'm like, what's that? It's like, it's perch from the Nile. It's, you know, perch that they pull out of the Nile. I'm like, what's that sausage? So I immediately started eating meat in Prague, put on 10 pounds immediately. And it was great. It was exhausting. You know,
I heard the restaurants in Prague are great.
Restaurants are spectacular.
I heard that.
Spectacular.
Yeah.
If you are...
I think Joe Carnahan shot something there, something he told me. He goes, Matt, the food here is fucking phenomenal.
Food's fucking amazing. The Italian food, or the Czech food's amazing. My favorite Czech dish was like braised. They like a duck.
Yeah, right.
Like a braised duck, and they like braised red cabbage and something they call a Carlsbad dumpling, which is they take all the bread that's been like in the kitchen.
Sure.
They chop it up and they basically make it into a sausage, and they boil the sausage, and then they cut it into slices, and then they put it under the duck and pour gravy over.
Oh my God, that sounds great!
It's phenomenal.
Oh.
So the food was great. I gained a lot of weight, and, it was stressful, but it was great. We shot.
Is that one of those countries where? Because of its progressiveness, the restaurants, they cost more or they cost less?
They cost less.
Okay, so everything just kind of costs less in Prague.
Everything costs less. And the funny thing is that it's not only that, but it's a... it's a situation like there's a Michelin star restaurant there called Field, which is like super like farm to table, like, but like roe deer, you know, and like eel, like stuff that they like hunted
typical
in the countryside.
Typical Michelin star restaurant there,
Yes, but I'm like I love food, but I don't have the kind of money to pay for that shit all the time. There, it was like, you know, four courses for like $80.
Right, you think it's gonna be like French laundry, and you're gonna spend like $2,000 on a meal.
It was like $80. I was like, it's incredible.
Wow,
with wine.
That's great.
Yeah, so I mean, it was great. It was great over there, and I love that people are super hardworking and they hate the Soviets like crazy. So, but there's this weird sort of like hangover from, you know, 40 years of Soviet domination, which you encounter. And so we end up shooting over there, and then basically what ends up happening is, you know, I remember saying, like, it's great. I can't live over there. I can't run the writer's room out of Prague. I can't fly my writer's to Prague. So, it, you know, wherever we shoot, you know, we got to shoot a series elsewhere. Yeah, no problem. So the pilot shows up, and it looks like a movie.
Yeah.
Thank you, Peter Atencio. Thank you, our brilliant editors. And all of a sudden, it's like, well, it's got to be Prague.
Yeah, right.
And so we're like,
so good. Yeah. You don't have an option now.
So now
they want that every week.
Now we're all moving to Prague.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say we, my entire cast and my director, but not me.
So, like, you, the writer's room, are they staying here?
We were in 444 Lakeside, next to the smokehouse across from Warner Brothers.
I was going to say, were you in NoHo or Burbank?
Yeah,
they usually put you in one of those little, like, offices.
Yeah.
People don't know how writer's rooms sometimes work if you're sometimes not on the lot.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, I eat lunch at Vicious Dogs a lot in NoHo.
Yeah.
And Bob's Burgers, their writer's room used to be, I don't know if it still is because it's gotten huge, but the first season was in this corporate office building down the block.
Yeah.
And they would come in every day for lunch. I would see them, and I'm like, well, what are you guys working on? And they're like, oh, this show, Bob's Burgers. And I'm like, where are you working? And I'm like, where are you working? And they'd be like, oh, that office building right there. I'm like, it's a corporate office. And that's how I learned.
Yeah.
That's how I
it's
learned.
Crazy.
They put you in a building.
We got really lucky. We lucked into this
space.
Gorgeous office. And the third floor was us. It was like a layer cake. It was us. No, we were in the second floor, so it was like...
Love the smokehouse, by the way.
It's great, right?
Great.
I love it.
Good time. Great atmosphere.
Great atmosphere. You see George Clooney sitting in the bar a lot. It's awesome.
A lot of fun.
Just hanging out, talking to the bartenders. So this office was like Swamp Thing, which is on DC, I think the streaming platform, the Warner Bros. Streaming platform. Yeah. Swamp Thing was on the third floor.
Okay.
Whiskey Cover was on the second floor, and Gotham was on the ground floor. So we'd see each other in the elevators and stuff, but we got in trouble a lot because we had a ping pong table and a bunch of shit, and like people, my writers tend to get rowdy, so we got yelled at.
A little loud.
We got yelled at by Gotham. I was kind of like, guys,
not fun unit.
Guys, I like your show and everything, but you're writing about the Penguin. You can relax.
Yeah, you're taking things a little seriously.
Exactly. Chill out. So, so we started writing the show. We got into writer's room second week of June of 2018.
And how long does it take to like write one episode of a show?
You know, it's funny you should ask that because.
Or are you parsing out like you do one, you do one?
We typically do a. Here's how we break it. Here's how we do it. We typically do a long pre-production story break period where. We'll break one episode at a time. We go, okay, what do we need to do with the episode two? The interesting thing about Whiskey was, like, episode two was actually aired third.
Right.
I wrote pilot two and then the season finale, which turned out to be the series finale. But the way it typically happens is you break one, and once that's... I like to run three rooms. One is kind of a rewrite room.
Right.
One is kind of an outline room. And one is a brainstorming room. If you have a large enough staff, you can do it. So we were kind of running three rooms all the time. So I'd be working on, okay, if I'm off on script on two, then three should be toward the end of the outline and getting ready to be handed off to a writer. And then four will be in another room being blue-skied. And I would kind of go from room to room. I'd stop writing. I'd go, okay, where are we with the outline? I like this. But I'm going to go into episode four. Where's episode four? Well, here we are with episode four, and this is what we need to do and what we're trying to accomplish. Okay, I get that. I don't think it's really feeding what I'm trying to accomplish in two, so if they're going to run Succession, we got to be aware of that. Mm. So there was pretty much a constant...
You can't get too far ahead, almost.
You can't.
You want to make sure that
you're...
And
the other thing is, if you're not airing... And it's a mid-season, which is what happened to me, you're basically... betting on character dynamics. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Do you guys want any more water?
Some water. Some water. I said, I'll sorry about that, listeners. We're at a restaurant. I'll be sort of like, you know, I don't know what's going to work, man. Yeah. I don't know what's going to work. Sure. I'm making bets on chemistry that I haven't really seen on its feet.
Right.
And I'm going to shoot it, and it's not going to air until January, so who knows? So you need to see dailies start coming in. We started shooting in, I want to say, I was there for the first week of shooting, so that was late August, early September. So, you know, we start in June. We got like ten weeks.
Right.
Where we're not gonna see anything. So whatever you've written, you're going to have to adjust sometimes because you just put it on its feet. It's like, oh, my God, I didn't know there was that chemistry.
Yeah, right.
Oh, my God, I didn't know that worked. And so, you know, to the abbreviated version.
You want more of something, you need to dial back on
exactly,
something.
Exactly, exactly.
Sure.
And then, then cuts start coming in. And then the studio, the network is like, wow, we'd love two, but three feels like it really roots the chemistry more. And then somebody sees five, and they're like, gee, it should go 1, 3, 5. And you're like, no, it's slightly seared. You can't do that, so you got to fight with them
in right.
order. You know, and so then, you know, you've already shot two, but three is going to go before two. So what you got to do is you got to pick up some extra days, find some days in your schedule to change some shit in two so that it's now three.
And then just so people know, when you say light serial, because there's serial, which is like every episode, the character's storylines, it's all about their storylines.
Yes.
Like, this is a show with an overlapping
yes.
theme and overlapping, like, case of the week,
yeah.
But like you say, lightly serial, you can't mix up three and five
yeah.
because some things happen to three that will affect five.
Precisely.
And not the other way around.
Precisely, my friend.
Right. Right.
Like, I wrote two as a, if you watch episode three, it's episode two, so the thing is, like, I don't trust you, I'm never going to get close to you.
Yeah.
You know? So that really makes the most sense as the second episode, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As the second episode of the show, because as the... as the third episode of the show, it's like, you know, okay, you guys just did this thing where he seduced somebody and she kind of serenaded him and helped him seduce Belle Meyoung.
Yeah.
So haven't they already gotten over this? So what you got to do is you got to reshoot scenes where it's like, you know what happened? Remember what happened in Prague? Well, because of what happened in Prague, I don't trust you. So you try to use the closeness of what used to be three and is now two as a jumping point to reshoot. The portions of episode
right.
two are now three. I'm sorry, gang, if this is confusing, but you're trying to use the reshoots become sort of contingent upon the reordering.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, right, because you put episode three before two.
Yeah.
So now you got to do reshoots for two mm-hmm. that explain three, why three went before. And
yeah.
and that brings me to the question I was going to ask you is, how hard is it to communicate
uh-huh.
when you have one team in Prague and another team at Warner Brothers Los yeah. Angeles? Is it difficult?
You're asking all the great questions, buddy.
Yeah.
I must say, you know, this show was the best of times and it was the worst of times. You know, the Tale of Two Cities. It was a Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah.
But it's because, you know, it's like, it was the best of times because the cast was amazing, the director was amazing, my
great
staff
cast,
was amazing.
You're doing your dream project.
Doing my dream project based upon my buddy.
Yeah.
Who turns out to be the FBI advisor.
Yeah.
So he's on staff, you know, very cool with me, like airing his dirty laundry.
Yeah, right.
Nice. But, you know, it was the worst times, and, like, Prague was hard. It's hard, you know, because it's a 9-hour time difference. It's a 14-hour flight.
Yeah.
So right when they're going to bed, we're just showing up, you know. And so, you know, production meetings, because every episode you typically have a tone meeting, a production meeting, a kickoff meeting. So you have all these meetings with, like, department heads and directors,
right.
and there's a table read, and then there's like, okay, you guys shut up. You know, there's a machine gun assault. We don't have a castle, but we have a church. So all those questions have to be dealt with. When they're having that meeting at, like, you know, they're 9 hours ahead. So, you know, if they're having that meeting at 9 a.m. their time,
right.
it's midnight our time.
Midnight here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, my writers stand up till 1 or 2 in the morning to get on these phone calls.
That's why I was going to say, is it mandatory then that you just know you're going to be up till 2 a.m. to take these calls?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My writers were awesome. I had the best staff in the world. They were just like, they came to play, you know?
Yeah, they had to. You have to be completely devoted to the show at this point.
Yeah, completely. And, like, I would fly over, or Bill would fly over, Jeff would fly over, the executive producer would fly over.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't a straight line. I mean, I think by the time we got to episode seven in the order, which was when we introduced Marika's character, Martina.
Yeah, yeah.
That was one where we started realizing, okay, we're on the road. So it's out more. So, like, you know, kind of a lot of stuff came to a head in terms of, like, how do we manage shit that's outside Prague, you know?
Yeah.
And we experienced some of that because we went to Rome on episode 3, and we went to London on episode 3. Again, this would have been episode 2. We went to both Rome and London for those. And then in the series finale, season finale, we went to Austria, shot in the Alps. But a lot, you know, so much of it is like logistics, man.
Yeah.
Logistics, you know. And then you got your actors who are far from home, and they're living in the Czech Republic.
Too.
Yeah. It's hard.
Because I'm assuming sometimes you got an idea in the writer's room at 1 p.m.
Yeah.
And you want to call Scott.
Yeah.
You want to call Scott Foley, yeah. But he's in Prague.
Yeah.
And over there, it's like 10 p.m.
Yeah,
maybe
he's putting
asleep.
His kids to bed. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You know, and they're working their asses off,
right.
Too. And it's shoot days. They're,
so you're like, I want to call Scott, but do you sit on this idea till...
Emails. Yeah. We'd email and text.
Email. Okay, yeah.
And like, you know, if there's something urgent, I get a call immediately. But, you know, mostly it was about trying to manage the distance between... And that's where it really got challenging. I will say the show from about episode 8 through episode 13. So 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 6
about
episodes.
6 episodes, yeah.
The first 8, the first 7 were comparatively light.
Yeah.
And then the back 6 were a bear.
Yeah.
They were a bear. And like I went over for 2 weeks to shoot the finale.
The finale, yeah.
And it was great. But on the day-to-day, you know, it was like... communicating, and the actors gonna have questions for me, you know. What are the speed bumps I can tell you about? Ophelia Lovibond, who played Emma Davies,
yeah,
great actress, great in the role. I think a bit of a disconnect with regard to who the character was, even though I thought I explained it. And so I had to write her out earlier because we were like, okay, there's an artistic difference that we can't get past.
Yeah,
I'm being really candid with you. So okay, she's fine with being written out. I'm writing her out. Not just writing her out, but killing her off.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
So that had to happen.
That helped serve the series in a way,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah, I said...
it put real stakes in the series.
Yeah.
This can happen,
yeah,
on this,
yeah,
show.
And I'm glad you brought that up. It was very important to me on the show.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't know if anybody... I think Pace Magazine noticed this, which I appreciated. There's a super high body count on the show.
Yeah.
And I wanted there to be super high body count.
Yeah.
But the show was totally kind of an odd duck, and I hope in a good way, man.
No, I thought so.
Because I, you know, I loved...
Oh, were we talking about at Drinks last week? Moonlighting, Cheers.
Yeah.
James Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah, tonally, it is this romantic comedy... but serious.
Yeah.
There's a seriousness to it, too.
Yeah.
That, like we were just talking, stakes. There, yeah, are stakes on this show.
Yeah.
Which you don't usually get on a romantic comedy. Or,
yeah, it was an odd duck, but I wanted, yeah, to make this odd duck, and I'm very blessed that Warner Bros. Let me see me get away with it, because, you know, like...
It's very rare you get to make a show like this.
I got
this.
So lucky, man. And it's like, you know, even with an episode...
Especially network TV.
Totally. What was episode 8, but I think it was episode 10, where he tips over.
Yeah.
And he goes man on fire.
Yeah.
Like, that was originally going to be a what we call a bottle show, all shot at the drop.
Right.
We ended up doing a bottle show with Alderman escaping from the Hive. We shot that largely, you know, in the Hive.
Yeah.
Which kind of soaked up, and, you know, and of course, again, to be totally candid, the problem becomes you don't want to use the term bottle show around the network all the time because they think, okay, you don't want to spend money on it.
That, and I think you can confirm this. Some people in this business don't really understand, even in this business, what the term bottle show means.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Like, for instance, in Stranger Things season 2, mm-hmm, everyone's like, oh, and I've heard this from people in this business.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it went off the rails with that bottle episode with 11. And I go, what bottle episode with 11? There was an episode just about 11.
Yeah.
But that's not a bottle episode.
Yeah.
A bottle episode is one location.
Yep.
Like, this is where the show takes place.
Yeah, like a ship in a bottle.
Right, right, yeah, right. Yeah. And so people understand the bottle episode,
yeah,
meaning it's all in one location.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Which, by the way, is great for the studio because it saves money and creatively can be fantastic. But the network hears and they're like, you don't want to spend money.
Yeah, right. And you can move quicker too because you don't have to change locations.
Yeah, yeah. Sure, I mean, like, sure, the bottle show works for everybody.
Yeah,
you know, because it's,
yeah,
like it's a great way for your actors to rest. So originally, Man on Fire was going to be a bottle episode, but then we changed it. And I said, you know, one of the things I really pushed for was, like, at one point, Scott's character, Will, has got this guy who isn't implicated in Emma's death, and he's hanging him up from like a meat hook, and he douses him in gasoline, and Frankie shows up and he lights his,
yeah,
lighter and drops it, and she catches it, you know, but he fully intended to,
yeah, right,
set him on fire,
yeah,
you know. And so the two tones coexisting.
It was great to see him go to those lengths, though.
Yeah,
you need,
I dug
to
it.
You,
yeah,
need to.
To sort of like dimensionalize the character.
Yeah.
So, you know, by the time we got to 13, we were all really exhausted. I was very blessed in that my dear friend Eugene Casey flew out on his own dime. By the way, about a month after his mom died, Eugene had gone. He now does international consulting, so he'd gone to the Middle East to sort of train security forces against terrorists. And that got thwarted. That job he had, it's usually like these 5-week gigs he does all over the world. You know, he's basically a, here's how to be James Bond, right?
Yeah, right.
Here's how to basically repel a terrorist attack, and here's how to spot terrorists. Brilliant guy.
Well, hopefully doing this show was a little cathartic.
It was
for
cathartic
him.
For him, yeah. But he was supposed to be over there doing that, and was going to spend a couple of days on the B side. Tragically, his mother passed at about 89. He ended up coming back from, I think he was in Doha, Qatar, for like 72 hours, and had to fly back from the Middle East after 72 hours, and was just like fried.
Man.
Then flew back from Qatar, then took himself to Prague,
yeah,
and spent about a week with me in Prague, which was great because he got to be on the stage. He's in the show. Fans,
right, because 6 years ago, this was just a germ of a...
Yeah.
A phone call.
Yeah, yeah.
I broke up with Gigi.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. And basically,
he probably thinks this is never going to happen, this show.
I know.
You're like, I wrote a treatment for you. He's like, yeah, whatever. It's been sitting for...
Yeah, he was great about it. When I said to him, I said, look, man, this is kind of like, you know, and I was careful to say this is inspired by you. It's not, you know, based on you. It doesn't delve into your personal life or any of the stuff that really happened at the Biopic. You inspired the character.
But as someone, I can just assume, as someone who I've made 3 films and 2 pilots with my friends.
Yes.
With my friends. Not my Hollywood friends.
Yeah.
My high school friends.
Yeah.
My back home friends.
Yeah.
There is a real joy to being able to do this business.
Yes.
With your deep, long, personal friends. So I got to imagine, for you and Eugene, this is an unforgettable
year experience. I literally got back on Tuesday, like 72 hours ago.
Yeah.
I'm spending 5 days with him and my buddy Sean Barry and my buddy Jeff Hoppe. you know, just talking about our lives and talking about the experience we had. Those guys, by the way, those 3 guys flew out for the premiere.
Yeah.
You know, they were great.
Great friends.
Great friends.
Do you look at Eugene when you're at your trip last week and you go, do you see the shit we caused at Times Square? There's a billboard.
My God. Yeah, we should jump to that. So,
right?
So we end up going to...
So at what point are you worried about season 2 happening or not happening?
Well, when we got... Here's how it went in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Ratings on episode 1 came in. We were told, you're going to be on after the Oscars. We were ecstatic. We really kind of weren't on after the Oscars. We were more kind
of... As we discussed, you're like after the post show, after the... Yeah. You got to wait another hour.
And it's 1 in the morning at this point. So the East Coast numbers and, you know, gratefully, I don't think they held that against us. And we actually went up.
Yeah.
The following... The only show to go up. And we're like, oh my God, this is fantastic.
Well, your +7s were great.
Our +7s were crazy.
+7 was great.
+3s, +7s were insane. You know, they're great. And by the way, Hulu, apparently our Hulu viewership was fantastic.
Yeah, right.
But the problem is, if you look at that time slot on ABC, nothing's doing any business. And our lead-in wasn't great. We're coming off of, no disrespect to the shows, but we're coming off of 4 comedies.
Well, you're also up against the Dick Wolf franchise.
Precisely.
The Chicago franchise.
Precisely. Precisely, man.
Yeah.
And we're, and not only that, but we're behind 4 comedies. And yes, we're a dramedy, but, you know, here's my attitude. This
the
is
Goldbergs
about,
doesn't really set up Whiskey Cavalier.
I mean, here's the truth about my attitude toward Whiskey. Here's what hurt us, ultimately. I think it was borne out by the numbers. People showed up, they dug it, but then it started dropping off from a 0.7 to about a point, I think the lowest was like a 0.4. But while it's hitting a 0.4, it's also number 1 across all platforms.
I was going to say, and then you look at the +7s and the +3s, and we talked about this, it gets to week 13, and the spike in viewership was over 1 million viewers.
Like, yeah.
Everyone showed up.
Yeah.
It was the 2nd highest rated episode.
Thank you, man.
Which kind of makes you go, and then the first being the Oscars.
Yeah.
And so it kind of makes you go, okay, there is a viewership for this show.
Oh, yeah. Which is why that crazy thing happened. So, you know, we watch it kind of be in the bubble, and, you know, Bill Lawrence and Jeff Engel and me, and like, and now, by the way, now we've got the ATA, which is the agencies, and the Writers Guild, have gotten their whole license gotten fucked up. So like, we all have to fire our agents. So now my agent, who I love, my agent for 23 years, I can't count, you know, thankfully, because it was an existing package, I could count on them, you know, to help me. And they were great. Even though I fired them, they were great, you know. So we're all fighting to try to keep this thing alive. And we thought, apparently, the day before the Sunday, we were canceled on Mother's Day. And the day before that Saturday, we were on the schedule. And then NBC passed on an ABC production show. I don't even know what it's called. It's like a sci-fi show. No disrespect to anybody, but ABC looked at it and said, I think, we own this thing. Why don't we put it on our air, since ABC didn't own whiskey?
Yeah.
You know, and going forward, I think this vertical integration is going to be hugely important.
Especially for syndication. Yeah. And we're talking about all this integration with Hulu and Netflix and all these new ways to syndicate now. Yeah. They probably want to own, they would choose if something is one or the other.
Yeah.
Well, what do we own 100% of?
Yeah, and I mean, here's where I think they, I do think they made a mistake. I think that, you know, it would have had huge library value. I don't know exactly.
And they didn't let you shop it around, though.
We did. We tried to shop it around. But the problem is, like, something like Lucifer does three seasons and it's got an established fan base. It's like, where are you going to go with it? You know, it's like you one season. So the best bet was really going to be them, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I think they looked at it in the 10 o'clock hour and they had no other real estate. And they're like, it's never going to do any better business. But I'm like, you know, if they'd owned more or not, if they don't, I think if they don't owned all of it, we'd still be on there.
I do, yeah, absolutely.
You know, because we
came, you did better than anything else. That
Yeah. And we came so close, you know? Became so much so that the fans, God bless the fans, because they're the ones who kept it, like, you know, there was all these articles about it. And by the way, it wasn't bullshit. I was getting calls at home from the brass, left, right, and center, going, hey, this could actually happen. You know, I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah, we all thought. Yeah. We all thought. To be honest, me and my friends in the business, when we were talking about it, we were surprised it didn't happen.
Yeah.
When you got fans taking out billboards.
Yeah, in Times Square and sending shot glasses, hashtag Save Whiskey Lovers. They were sending shot glasses to ABC. And
I mean, it was a perfect storm of, you have this great concept for a show. There's nothing else like it on TV. You got Scott Foley, who's a cult star. And you have Lauren Cohen, who's a cult star.
Yeah.
She's got Walking Dead. You got Scott from Scandal, but also he has that Felicity fan base from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's this perfect storm of hardcore fans, and you would think after you saw the hardcore fans, you'd be like, we better give this a second season. Because, by the way, you've been in this business long enough that you know, I'm talking out my ass saying it, but Cheers.
Yeah.
First season was rated last in the
ring. Last.
You don't know. This could have been the biggest hit of next year.
Yeah, totally. So. And it's like, and I think we would have had a huge traction, and it's like, because, you know, God bless the fans. Like, you know, the thing that like brought me to tears, and I'll be totally honest with you, is like, I get fan art. I get fan fiction.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
I get people reaching out to me
and
going, like,
you did other great shows, but nothing like that.
Nothing like that.
You don't get anything like that.
It was crazy, man. And I'm like, I don't, you know, I'm like, I'm responding to fans individually. They're sending me these beautiful posters and, like, you know, all this awesome stuff. And I'm like, this is gorgeous. This
you got that Comic-Con audience.
Yeah.
You
get
that, yeah.
Yeah, it was huge, you know. Yeah. So, you know, I think the long and the short of it is, Matthew, that, you know, we did the best we could. And I think the business is fundamentally changing. We've been friends for a while.
Yeah.
You know, probably back to my Fox days.
That's right.
Long time.
That's right.
And we've seen it change together, you know. And it's like, we've seen how, you know, just distribution is being revolutionized. And I think the thing now is, if you don't own it, they own the distribution, channels of distribution. So if you don't own it and can't distribute it yourself, then why continue?
I was going to say, so what does that mean for you as a writer and for people in the future that go to Warner Brothers and Sony and Paramount? Well, now Paramount has a TV channel.
Yes.
But Warner Brothers and Sony, it's like they're going to outsource these shows to a degree.
Well, they've got the CW.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You know, if you look at the trades now, it's all like Warner Media, Warner Streaming hires, like, it was a time I was like getting on Deadline. It's like every third article was like, Warner Streaming hires X, Warner Streaming hires Wire. Like, people are leaving ABC, people are leaving, like,
Fox. Well, now they got a new CEO.
Yeah.
And they're, so and they're, we don't just know, like, what's going to happen.
Exactly. But what they're doing is,
and
like,
we know they're starting a streaming service.
Yeah. That's it, man. Warner Streaming. Like, that's going to, like, Swamp Thing is for Warner Streaming. And there'll be all tons of other shit for Warner Streaming. Like, Apple is ramping up, it's making a huge amount of content. Paramount is going to be selling. So, you know, Paramount can sell to third-party distributors. Sony will do that, too.
I'm assuming.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, Sony's got Crackle, right?
Yeah.
Because I watched a movie on Crackle yesterday, and I was like, oh, I forgot Crackle was here.
Yeah.
You know?
They need to do a better job with getting that out there.
Yeah.
And that's the other problem. You know, all my writer friends and everyone, we're all talking about how we have all these places to pitch to now, and we have all these outlets now. But some people don't even know these outlets exist.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, is my stuff even going to get seen?
Yeah.
You know, like, I'd like to make a show.
Yeah. I'd like people to see my show.
Yeah, right. I'd like,
So I think the economics are changing. I think you'll see shorter orders. I think you'll see smaller viewership. I think everybody still wants, you know, Friends. Everybody still wants Empire.
Yeah.
And, you know, those will exist, but I think you'll see in broadcast increasingly game shows, live action competitions like The Voice and American Idol. I think you'll see a few scripted programs increasingly, but I think a lot of the smaller stuff is going to be made for less money and smaller staffs on the streaming services.
What do you think moving forward now with your career you took from Whiskey Cavalier in a positive way that you're going to use moving forward? What are some of the things you liked so much about the experience? You're like, I'm going to do this in the future.
Oh, my God. I learned so much, man. But I can give you like five quick ones. One is it's all about cast.
Yeah.
And I've always known that. I did a pilot once that Bradley Cooper was supposed to star in after Kitchen. For some reason, I couldn't get him approved. It's insane. This is after Kitchen. This is 14 years ago.
Isn't that crazy? They were Bradley Cooper.
An unnamed executive said to me, he's not a star. You have a man crush on him. And I said, yeah, I do have a man crush on him because he's a star.
Yeah. You
know? But the point is that, you know, it's all cast. Like, the trick is this, and you know this already, because you're an accomplished writer, producer, director. Like, a great cast can make a mediocre script fantastic.
Yes.
And a shitty cast can make a brilliant script terrible.
Yep.
So it's all what happens on its feet. So get lucky with your cast, not that you can control it. That's number one. Number two, understand what you're trying to accomplish with maximum clarity before you assemble the writer's room. And when you do, that's number two. Number three, once you have that understanding and you know you can execute on the premise consistently so that it's sustainable and relatable, don't let the studio network push you off the dime.
Yeah.
You can avoid it. Don't change for them.
Because well, when you talk about the writer's room like that, are you talking in essence also like, I hired this writer because I know what his tools or her tools are, and that's what I need from her on this show.
Yes.
Are there certain writers that you hire, you bring in, and you're like, I know this person to be like such and such a person, who writes such and such a way.
Yeah.
I'm bringing them in specifically because they'll help with
this. Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll seek out writers that are in Shondaland because I want that Shondaland
the vibe.
Juice. The vibe.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, you know, that's three. Four would be boots on the ground. Like, never again am I going to do something where I don't have a writer on set all the time.
Yeah.
As brilliant as Peter was, is. Like, I want to be on set, or I want one of my writers on set. I want to be able to walk. If I, you know, ideally, I want to be able to walk across the street from my writer's office and go, like, what's the problem? Who's not doing what? What don't we understand? What's the crisis?
Next time, do you think, even if you have shooting a prog or something, maybe you hire another person to run the writer's room for you, and then you're in prog?
What I would do, and what I wanted to do in season two, would be to rotate three or four people over the course of the season.
Yeah.
So somebody over like two, three months. And then somebody else over 2-3 months. So there's never a writer offset.
That's smart.
And then the last thing would be to try to enjoy every single moment of it. I think I kind of succeeded in that because I knew, you know, Matthew, I've been to the altar so many times.
It's the most important thing, and, I mean, and we forget sometimes.
Yeah, it's my third TV show. I've run three other TV shows.
When I made Landline, I did not get to enjoy shooting at Wrigley Field as much as I would have liked.
Yeah, because all you can think about
My only memories of being there now are working.
Yeah.
Working.
And yeah, because all you're thinking about is like, shit, they weren't supposed to put a tarp over there.
Yep.
Why is that light out?
Yep.
You know?
I was a wreck that day.
Yeah.
And I didn't get to enjoy it as much as I should have.
So I think the final thing I learned was to enjoy every single moment of it.
Yeah, that's something I took from my last one, to start enjoying it more.
Enjoy
it,
just like I've enjoyed every single moment of this interview.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you
so much for lunch.
My pleasure.
And you know what? Congratulations, regardless, with Whiskey, because it's an achievement, to get that on the air and to do 13 weeks with it. And I think it's great.
Thank you,
I think it's great. Everyone's telling you that. Like, you're hearing it.
I'm here. I'm lucky. I work with some great people, and I'm lucky to have a man like you as a friend.
Thanks, Dave. And then hopefully when the next thing comes, we sit down and talk about
forever and always. Hopefully I'll be interviewing you for your thing.
Oh, yeah, I wish. Thanks, brother.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us on the Matthew Aaron Show. I hope you really enjoyed the oral history of Whiskey Cavalier with David Hemmingson. It's one of my favorite episodes we've ever done. He's one of the most intelligent men that you're ever going to meet. And just he finds a way to make this relatable for everybody out there. You don't have to be in TV and film to understand what he's talking about. And I really hope you got the gist of how the show was made and how the show came to an end. If there's any questions I missed, please let me know. I would love to maybe even do a follow-up and ask Dave some more if it helps you. Next week, we're going to do an oral history with Adam Simon on the new film Point Blank, which is coming out on Netflix July 12th. That's going to be a can't-miss show because between Adam and I, you never know what's going to be said. So please tune in. Next week, I'm going to drop Adam Simon,